Just days before the start of the Olympics, Tokyo declares a state of emergency due to COVID. The games will go on, but no fans in the stadiums is leaving some athletes deflated.
The Olympics, the way it's going to go on, is not the Olympics. Like, that's not what it is.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, doctors from Cuba travel widely, but Cuban officials are now fuming over a U.S. government report that says the country is trafficking doctors.
Many people allege that, you know, these doctors go voluntarily without recognizing that these doctors are a captive labor force.
And why are students in Canada crafting prom outfits from duct tape?
It feels comfortable most of the time. I can't exactly sit down.
17 rolls of duct tape, you can start to see why. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us this Thursday. We begin with President Biden speaking at the White House today. He announced the U.S. mission in Afghanistan will end in August. Most foreign troops have left the country as fighting between the Taliban and Afghan forces is intensifying. The World's Shireen Jafari has been our reporter on the Afghanistan story. Shireen, what did Biden actually say today?
Marco, like you said, Biden said the U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan will end on August 31st. That's earlier than what the administration had announced before, which was September 11th. And Biden also said it's time for the U.S. to end its involvement in this war because it is clear that there is no military solution. He said the U.S. achieved what it went to Afghanistan to achieve, which was to get Osama bin Laden, to make sure that Afghanistan doesn't become a safe haven for terrorist groups against the U.S. And Biden feels like that goal has been accomplished. The way Biden sees it, it's time for the U.S. to focus its energy and attention on other places in the world, like China and the Middle East. Let's have a listen to what Biden said.
How many thousands more Americans' daughters and sons are you willing to risk? How long would you have them stay? Already we have members of our military whose parents fought in Afghanistan 20 years ago. Would you send their children and their grandchildren as well? Would you send your own son or daughter?
Marco, Biden's comment was in response to a question that some people have been posing and saying that why is it that the U.S. can stay longer in Afghanistan given the current security situation? But Biden also said that the U.S. is not abandoning Afghanistan. He said that the U.S. is committed to continue with the peace process and that it will provide Afghans with humanitarian help and also some military assistance for the Afghan forces. He said, you know, a Taliban takeover is not inevitable.
And yet most foreign troops are now out of Afghanistan. What are you hearing about conditions on the ground?
The Taliban continues to take districts mostly in the north and northwest of the country. They have been focusing on strategic locations like border crossings and main highways. Today, for example, we are hearing reports that the Taliban fighters have taken over a border crossing between Afghanistan and Iran called Islam Qal'e. This is an important crossing point, not just for trade, but also for a lot of refugees who cross this point into Iran and Afghanistan and back and forth. There was also this week other news about Taliban advances in other places. For example, 1,000 Afghan troops fled to Tajikistan because they couldn't hold off Taliban assault. Another major development this week was that there was a prison break in a province called Badghis in the northwest, and officials there are saying that about 200 prisoners have escaped. Now, I should say that Afghan forces are responding to Taliban offenses as much as they can, and they have been able to take back some of the districts that Taliban took over, but they are finding themselves in a really tough spot, Marco, because they're no longer able to have the same U.S. air support that they did before the withdrawal.
Right. And what about peace talks, Shireen? Where do they stand?
There have been some developments in recent days. There was a meeting between Taliban and Afghan representatives in Tehran, Iran, this week. And this meeting was hosted by Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif. And Zarif said the point of this meeting was to help the two sides come together and to discuss the peace process. The hope is that these negotiations sort of help accelerate the talks in Doha, which have been stalled for a while now. But at the end of the day, it's up to the Afghan government and the Taliban to agree on a ceasefire and a peace deal. And this is exactly what President Biden said today in his speech.
The world, Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
There's big news out of Japan today. The country's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga announced this morning that Tokyo will be under a state of emergency starting this Monday until August 22nd. That covers the entire stretch of the Summer Olympics, which led to another big announcement: no fans allowed in the stands. The world's Bianca Hillier has been covering the challenges of the Tokyo Olympics. Bianca, first of all, what are the details of the state of emergency? What measures are actually being taken?
Yeah, so Prime Minister Suga said this is a precautionary measure to prevent the coronavirus from spreading out of densely populated Tokyo to other parts of the country. One of the main changes the city will see is that bars and restaurants won't be able to serve any alcohol during this period, and department stores will also close earlier, around 8 p.m. But I want to make clear that this is not a lockdown, so we'll still see busy streets in Tokyo. They're just taking these steps now because cases are rising, vaccine rates are low, and officials are concerned about the Delta variant.
Right. The state of emergency is to protect people in Japan, but of course the Olympics are set to start in just 15 days, and now they'll go on without fans. Is that going to be for all events?
It's for all events in Tokyo. That's indoor and outdoor venues. But not all events are being held in Tokyo. And in those cases where there's not a state of emergency, spectator capacity will be up to local governments. So we could see some fans in some situations. But this ban of local fans in Tokyo is a major change from just 2 weeks ago, when you'll remember that organizers announced venues could be at 50% capacity, up to 10,000 people. Tokyo 2020 Olympics President Saiko Hashimoto spoke at a press conference today. She apologized to people who had purchased tickets, but says it's now necessary for the games to be a made-for-TV event.
Bianca, as you've been reporting, there have been repeated calls for the Olympics to be canceled. Is there still any chance of that happening?
No, there's been no talk of canceling the Olympics. Here's IOC Vice President John Coates back in May responding to a question about whether the Games would be held under a state of emergency.
Well, we've successfully seen five sports hold their test events during the state of emergency. All of the plans that we have in place to protect the safety and security of the athletes and the people of Japan are based around the worst possible circumstances, and so the answer is absolutely yes.
Prime Minister Suga tried to reassure viewers today that they shouldn't worry about not being able to attend the games in person, considering that 4 billion people watch on TV anyway, but it will, without a doubt, lead to a different environment.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I can imagine athletes are going to notice the change. What are athletes saying about all this?
Right. This lack of crowds is a big deal to some athletes. One of them, Australian tennis player Nick Kyrgios, said earlier this month he was already considering not competing at the games if the stands are empty.
If I'm to play the Olympics, I've said it numerous times, I want to do it the right way. I want to do it with full crowds. I want to do it with my guests there. I want to do it when I'm able to watch other athletes do their thing. And that's the Olympics for me. The Olympics, the way it's going to go on, is not the Olympics.
Kyrgios hasn't officially pulled out of the games yet, but he posted on Instagram yesterday that he does intend to play in a tournament in Atlanta, which just happens to run at the same time as the Olympics, and can't be two places at once. So, yeah, this is impacting players.
Right, yeah, in many ways. The world's Bianca Hillier with the latest on the Tokyo Olympics, a state of emergency declared and no spectators allowed. It's going to be different. Thanks, Bianca.
Thanks, Marco.
The border between the U.S. and Canada is still restricted, as it's been for 16 months. That's been a big problem for U.S. border towns that rely on Canadians crossing over to shop and do business. A prime example, Point Roberts, Washington. It's on the north side of Puget Sound, isolated from the U.S. mainland, but connected to a peninsula in British Columbia. Benjamin Payne has our story.
These days, it's tough for Americans like me to get to Point Roberts. Before the pandemic, I could drive through British Columbia to get here. Now, my only option is a two-hour ferry ride from the city of Bellingham, Washington, population 90,000, to Point Roberts, population 1,000. Residents here get their electricity from Canada, their water from Canada, and, until the pandemic, most of their business from Canada. When I walk into the only grocery store in town, the aisles are stocked, but customers are almost nowhere to be seen.
July 1st, today's Canada Day. Sunday's July 4th. This should be my absolute kick-butt week of the year.
That's Allie Hayton. She's the owner of this place, the Point Roberts International Marketplace. But these days, it's not so international.
To operate on $50,000 of volume a week, when in a peak summer month like this, we should be doing $350 a week, it's just not sustainable.
Hayton had been banking on the border to reopen at the end of June, but then the U.S. and Canada extended the closure.
When they announced that they were going to extend it another month, it was soul-crushing is the only way I can describe it. It was the first time I ever felt absolutely defeated, like I can't do this anymore.
Later on in our interview, something, or rather someone, grabs Hayton's attention out of the corner of her eye. A white-haired gentleman, 80 years old, is looking through the window of Hayton's office. It's Brian Calder, president of the Point Roberts Chamber of Commerce. He's holding up a bright orange T-shirt.
And it says, Inmate 3-2020, Point Roberts Lockdown.
3-2020, as in March 2020, when the border shutdown began.
I'm selling T-shirts. We got them yesterday at 2, and I sold 15, and I got 4 online orders from Minnesota.
He's driving around town, selling them to raise awareness of what feels to many like economic imprisonment. So I hitch a ride with Calder in his truck. He takes me just down the road to Point Roberts Shell Center, a general store and gas station. Manager and part owner Chuck Laird tells me they used to have 18 full-time employees. Now they're down to just one, him.
And we can't afford to make my regular paycheck. So I'm working like double hours for the same amount of money. My daughter's over here working for free just to keep the doors open.
As a sign of just how reliant the town is on Canadians, gas here is sold by the liter. The next stop is Point to Point Parcel, a shipping and receiving warehouse. It's on the same block as the port of entry into Point Roberts. Calder's niece, Beth, is manager and part owner.
We just celebrated our 20-year anniversary of being in business, and it's been a struggle. We almost feel like we've kind of gone back 20 years.
That's because their business model is built around Canadian citizens. In normal times,
95%+ of our business is giving an address to a Canadian to be able to use the mail order system in the U.S., and they have it shipped here, and then they come across the border.
But with the border closed, Canadians can't come down to pick up their packages. And she says most Canadians don't want to have them shipped up north, since the cost of international shipping shot up during the pandemic. And about that border crossing just down the block?
Now my biggest fear is it's going to reopen and there's no staff. I laid off 8 of my 10 staff last March, and most of them have relocated. So I've been struggling trying to find staff to start coming back with the anticipation of the border actually reopening, and I'm not getting anywhere.
Other small business owners I spoke with that day have similar stories of struggle. A building supplies store without its base of Canadian property owners. A cafe that just reopened on a trial run, testing if it can stay afloat this summer without the hordes of hungry Canadians. Come evening, it's time for me to hop back on the ferry. The captain comes on the speaker.
Sit back and enjoy the 2-hour trip down to Bellingham.
It's a long ride, but at least I know when I'm getting home, back to normal. For the businesses and residents of Point Roberts, there's no telling when, or even if, normal will return. For the world, I'm Benjamin Payne.
A U.S. diplomat's sober assessment of the crisis in Haiti, that's coming up next. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The political and security crisis continues in Haiti after gunmen assassinated the country's president, Jovenel Moïse, early yesterday morning. Now, according to Haitian authorities, police have killed 4 suspects behind the assassination and arrested 2 others. But who was behind the killing and why remains unclear, along with who is actually leading Haiti now and further down the road. Pamela White joins me now. She served as U.S. ambassador to Haiti from 2012 to 2015. She's now with the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. First of all, Ambassador White, what was your reaction when you heard that Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, was killed?
Someone called me at like 4 o'clock in the morning and they said, have you heard? You heard it. I'm like, have I heard what? And they said, President Moïse has been assassinated. And I've known Haiti for many, many years because I first served there for 5 years from 1985 to 1990. So, you know, I've been very familiar with its rocky past. But even remembering what went on when the United States and France and others managed to convince Baby Doc to leave the country in the complete chaos that I experienced after that departure, this is another level, and I feel deeply saddened, and of course, for President Moïse's family.
Can you take us back then a little? I mean, in 2015, you were the U.S. ambassador to Haiti when Moïse was just running for office. What can you tell us about him? How did he come to power?
Well, he was very good friends with President Martelly, and President Martelly really brought him into the inner circle. He was kind of known up north as being a banana farmer, so we didn't really know very much about him. You know, Moïse, the 4 or 5 times that I met him struck me as being incredibly shy and uncomfortable in the political role which he had taken on. Here's the problem, I think, that maybe the real root of the problem, and that is the voice of the Haitian people is not heard through elections. When Moïse was elected, I think it was 22% of the population even bothered to come outside their door. Of that 22%, he got 11% of the population to vote for him. So he had no mandate ever.
I mean, the political instability has led to social upheaval. We've seen thousands of families taking shelter in Haiti, displaced by violent clashes between armed gangs. What's fueling those clashes between the gangs?
Well, the money. It's rumored. I have never seen any proof of this, but a lot of the private businessmen, the elite of the elite, each have their own private interest, and some of them fund these gangs. Sometimes, as horrible as to say, but the worse Haiti gets, the richer certain people get. Certainly this was true during the earthquake. I mean, the richest of the Haitians made millions and millions off that earthquake. The richest take it off the top, and there's very little left to develop the country. I think that's what's happening, and people get very, very angry, and they want that to be known. And your politics has been wrapped up in violence in Haiti since Papa Doc left. And before. So it's a long, 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 long history. Even the police is infiltrated with corrupt individuals on the take. So there's no security mechanism down there that really is working. And the justice system is in shambles, too. I mean, Moïse fired 3 or 4 Supreme Court judges. This is no parliament. So everywhere you look, there is a void.
I'm speaking with Pamela White, the U.S. ambassador to Haiti from 2012 to 15. Ambassador, as you said, economic crisis and poverty has contributed to the deep political crisis in Haiti. The U.S. has given Haiti billions of dollars in aid over the last decade. From your perspective, how impactful has that aid actually been?
Well, you know, I tell people that in the 5 years after the earthquake, we did miraculous things with the help of the Haitian people. We employed tens of thousands of people. We rebuilt roads. We rebuilt the port. We rebuilt the airport. We built schools. We trained teachers. We built a health delivery system that was, I mean, it wasn't perfect, but it was functioning. Some of my favorite people in Congress would say to me, but Ambassador White, why haven't you turned this around? Why haven't you even turned this around? And I was like, listen, after Katrina, we gave New Orleans $40 billion to rebuild one city. And Haiti was given $2 billion by the United States to rebuild Haiti. We did wonderful, wonderful things there after the earthquake. There's no doubt about it. But it wasn't enough money to get down deep enough to change the fact that people did not have the skills to build Haiti back better. And that was going to take years to do. And in the meantime, chaos starts raising its ugly head. And you can't do long-term development in the middle of chaos. You can't expect them to rebuild a country when they're afraid to go outside their door.
$2 billion is not as much as the $40 billion that went to New Orleans, but $2 billion for Haiti, comparatively speaking, is huge. Critics say the bedlam in Haiti has been enabled over time by the U.S., perhaps with the best intentions, no doubt. But I'm wondering, what would you have done differently if you could have?
Well, yeah, my whole career, I should have done this, I could have done that. But I think maybe we should have concentrated more on 2 areas instead of 8 areas. I mean, it does sound like a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money when you're doing big-time infrastructure. And the country was, you know, in shambles. There was enough rubble to fill dump trucks from Florida to Maine. The whole city was under. There was no parliament building. There was no schools. Tens of thousands of teachers were killed. Tens of thousands of health workers. I mean, you had a country that was trying desperately to move forward. And I do think that you can't abandon Haiti. I do know that without investing in security, both food security and physical security, Haiti is not going to move forward. I'm sure of it. And I do not believe elections will help it move forward at this time either.
Well, you spoke earlier, Ambassador, about the wisdom of holding the elections in the midst of this crisis, if it continues. State Department spokesman Ned Price says the view from Washington is that elections that are scheduled in Haiti this year should proceed. Other experts on Haiti say slow down with the current instability and violent conditions. A push for new elections is dangerous. What do you think?
That's what I think. I think we have to find a mechanism to hear the Haitian people's voices, and I do not believe that an election will get that done. Even the last elections in 2016-17, they were very chaotic also, and 20% of the people came out and voted. The rest said, we don't believe in these elections, we don't consider them valid, and we're not coming out, and then only 10% of them voted for Mui. So when you get to an election, and that's the turnout you have, and that's the interest of the Haitian people in an election at all, I think you have to look at it for a better solution.
So let's talk about that solution briefly. How do you see the U.S. role in trying to give Haitian people a voice? Is it unilateral? Is it working through the UN? What's the next step here?
We have got to get talking about how do Haitians feel that we need to rebuild Haiti. And people say that all the time, you know, this is the Haitians' problem to solve and the Haiti needs to take care of Haiti. Well, okay, how do we get that done? Especially at a time when elections, to me, seems so far-fetched, when there are no mechanisms to oversee an election. There's no real judiciary. The opposition is there. They said they will not participate in an election under the current circumstances, so you don't even have any opposition. You don't have any really viable candidates. You just can't say, let's have an election, and it miraculously happens. We say we don't, but the United States equates democracy with an election, and I don't. I equate a democracy with people's voices being heard, and I don't think we've found the right mechanism in Haiti to make that happen, and we've got to do that.
Pamela White was the U.S. ambassador to Haiti from 2012 to 2015, speaking with us about Haiti's political crisis following the assassination of their president, Jovenel Moïse. Thank you very much, Ambassador.
Thank you so much.
On a billboard overlooking the busy Shinjuku neighborhood of Tokyo is a giant 3D cat. The hyper-realistic 4K image is startling some pedestrians. You got to see it to believe it. The photo is in our Top of the World newsletter. Sign up and check out the giant kitty at theworld.org/newsletters. You're listening to The World. College students are looking forward to getting back on campus this fall. For some international students, though, there are still plenty of pandemic hurdles to get over, including getting the right vaccination.
I know many students who basically have gotten just worn out of all these issues, and they've deferred or they've just let go of their admission.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. When temperatures climbed to record levels in the Pacific Northwest last week, most people scrambled to find relief from the heat. But for scientist Farron Anslow, it was time to get to work.
I went into my desk and sat in front of a fan and basically poured water over myself as I was analyzing the data as it came in.
Anslow is a climatologist in Victoria, British Columbia. He's part of the World Weather Attribution Group. His team has been working nonstop to answer a key question about the cause of last week's heat wave.
Is it climate change, or is climate change playing a role?
And the answer is a resounding yes. Anslow's team came to this conclusion by comparing how likely it would be that last week's heat wave would have occurred in a climate that had the greenhouse gas levels from the 1800s. In other words, from before the Industrial Revolution.
With climate change, it made this event 150 times more likely than without human-induced climate change.
Global temperatures have risen more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the past two centuries, a number that sounds tiny but could be catastrophic. Anslow says that if that rise continues, last week's extreme heat could become a regular occurrence in the region, and not just extreme heat.
But the other thing we see in the model is the variability could be changing as well, more extreme highs, more extreme drought, more extreme heavy precipitation events.
Anslow hopes his study can help people understand the increasing threat of climate change.
It really gives credence to our projections of climate change. It it really drives home that the climate is warming. We know it's going to warm more, and so we better start doing something about it.
Temperatures in Seattle and Portland hit well over 100 degrees last week, and Canada broke its national record 3 days in a row, reaching a high of 121 degrees Fahrenheit. Scientists estimate that hundreds of people died as a result of the heat wave. The heat also led to the deaths of some 1 billion marine animals. The impacts that climate change is causing lead to a different kind of problem, a security threat. It's something that our friend Lacey Healy at the PRX National Security Podcast, Things That Go Boom, has looked at closely. Here again is Lacey.
Flooding and wildfires might not immediately come to mind when you think about national security. Usually that's the more obvious stuff that goes boom. But over the past 3 decades, the security community has come to see climate change more broadly that way. The first explicit recognition of the threat came in 1990, when a Naval War College report warned that naval operations in the coming half century could be drastically affected by the impact of global climate change. But concerns have only grown, as climate has become, according to the Pentagon in 2015, a present security threat, not strictly a long-term risk. It's a big topic, so we decided to bite off a smaller piece of it and focus solely on the risks from climate migration. Overseas, but also first, right here at home.
I'm Jesse Keenan. I'm an associate professor of real estate at the Tulane School of Architecture.
Jesse focuses on climate adaptation and the places where we live and work here in the U.S. He's the guy you call if you're not sure if you should build that third mansion on the Florida coast. But he's also convinced that we are on the cusp of a great northern migration that could make millions of us more vulnerable. He says people will flee flooding and wildfires on the coasts and deadly heat waves in the south.
Yeah, I think some portion of our country will participate in a great northern expanse. You know, the range of plants and animals in the northern hemisphere is moving slower and slower north. We measure this across dozens of species. They're slowly moving north. Well, guess what? People are going to do the same thing, right? Over time, we are going to slowly move further and further north until we become an extreme annoyance to our Canadian neighbors.
In a major report, ProPublica found that in the coming years, Buffalo, New York might come to feel more like Tempe, Arizona does today. And fresh water will become even more scarce. As a result of climate change, places like Miami, New York, and Boston will be profoundly altered. The report said, imagine dozens of new bridges connecting the islands of Philadelphia.
And I think that the scale, you know, when you think about other great American migrations like the Dust Bowl, you know, it's 4 to 5 times the size of the Dust Bowl, potentially. Ugh. It could easily be 30 million people or more, you know, approximately 8% to 10% of the population may be in transit. And these are relatively conservative estimates.
To be fair, Keenan is talking about a shift over a longer period of time. In 2019, the intelligence community's worldwide threat assessment called climate change an urgent and growing threat to our national security. There's even a think tank here in D.C. dedicated solely to examining the security risks posed by climate change.
I'm Francesco Femmia. I am the co-founder and research director at the Center for Climate and Security.
He's trying to figure out how prepared the military might be for what's to come, especially where climate migration is concerned, and especially in the world's hotspots. Although sidebar here, he agrees with Jesse Keenan that this is also a big concern right here domestically.
I spoke with a former vice admiral of the Coast Guard, and I asked him, you know, if we were to get a Katrina Sandy-style storm.
Massive chunks of boardwalk littering the streets, street after avenue after cul-de-sac.
One after the other.
And with much of New Orleans now underwater, authorities are focused on search and rescue.
And then, meanwhile, we have wildfires raging in the west.
Smoke mushroomed into thick blankets of clouds so vast they could be seen from space.
This was 3 years ago, I asked. Are we prepared to deal with that in a way that's acceptable to the American public? He said flatly, no, we're not prepared. And it was a little bit surprising. That has consequences for political stability in this country and potentially for security. And that's now.
Even in the U.S., it's not unreasonable to think that the impacts of climate change could lead to food and water shortages, devastate homes and land, and in some cases, cause mass migration. And all of these things can aggravate existing stressors.
Climate change
is what we in our community call a threat multiplier, to say that climate change makes other security problems worse. It's really that simple. So if there's a place that doesn't get a lot of water already, then climate change might drive increased drought and a decrease in precipitation in those areas. And when people don't have a lot of water, that can lead to instability, displacement of peoples, and ultimately even conflict.
Syria, in some ways, is a good example of how climagration can become a stressor. Francesco says he became interested in Syria almost by accident. His team was studying a water project in Libya at the time, and this was 2012. So they were poring over precipitation maps from the previous 20 years.
And we noticed that Syria was bright red, and bright red means bad.
The red showed a dramatic precipitation decline.
And we started looking in further because at the time, the Syrian civil war was in its essentially its first year. And we thought, well, okay, that's interesting. And we noted that there was a major drought, actually considered the most extreme drought in its recorded history, that happened from 2007 until 2010.
Later research determined climate change had made the drought two or three times more likely. Coupled with natural resource mismanagement by the Assad regime, it decimated large swaths of farmland and sent as many as 2 million people to urban centers. When they arrived, many found that the city that they turned to for a new start didn't have the capacity to house, clothe, or care for them.
And there were other social and economic inequalities at play. There was favoritism from Assad towards certain ethnic groups over others. There were all kinds of reasons why people were upset.
Residents pour onto the streets to mourn 138 people killed overnight by government shelling.
Of course, you can't draw a direct line from climate change to the Syrian civil war. And you can't draw a direct line from climagration in Syria to climagration in the U.S. But Syria can teach us a lesson here about the future of conflict in the age of climate crisis. Sure, we will have water wars and direct battles over resources, but most conflicts don't sprout from a single source. They're a knotted collection of grievances, several pieces of kindling gathered together before they ever find a spark. When the military talks about the climate crisis as a threat multiplier, they're saying that it's going to stack a lot of kindling, enough to start a fire.
Climate change can contribute to displacing people. And when that happens in large numbers, in certain contexts, that can drive conflict, political instability. And then that can drive regional insecurity.
According to the UN, more than 400,000 people have been killed in Syria since the start of the war. And millions more have been displaced. At the same time, countries that have become hosts to Syrian as well as Afghan and Iraqi refugees have seen the reinvigoration of a hyper-nationalistic right wing.
So you get this isolationism, this sort of ethno-nationalism. That's a security problem.
Today, just 1% of the world is considered a hot zone, too hot to live. But if current trends continue, a new study has found that could rise to 19%, affecting a third of the global population. That's a lot of people who would have to move. Francesco says rejoining the Paris Agreement is a no-brainer, but he says we need to go way beyond that. If we don't act faster, he says, just think of this scene in Austin Powers.
It's a parody of a James Bond scene with a bunch of people in this warehouse shooting at each other. And there's a security guard who's facing off against Austin Powers. Austin Powers is driving a steamroller.
Hang on, I'm gonna floor it.
Austin Powers is yelling at the guy, move, get out of the way.
Move.
And for anybody who knows, steamrollers are just really slow. And instead of running out of the way, the security guard puts his hand out and just yells no for about 2 minutes. And then Austin Powers just slowly rolls over.
Right. And that's the thing. It's a slow roll. Maybe that makes it easier to ignore.
That's Lacey Healy from the PRX and National Security Podcast, Things That Go Boom. This story was produced by Ruth Morris and Robin Wise. We've been featuring Things That Go Boom all week on The World. You can check out more of their work wherever you get your podcasts. Their new season is dropping right now. An update now to a story we brought you earlier this week about former South African President Jacob Zuma and his refusal to accept a prison sentence. Last night in KwaZulu-Natal in central South Africa, police were getting ready to arrest Zuma while reporters and well-wishers were at the gates of his home. Less than an hour before the midnight deadline, a motorcade sped out of Zuma's compound, carrying the former president to jail. Government sources confirmed that he was taken to Escort Correctional Center to begin serving a 15-month prison sentence. Last Sunday, Zuma anticipated this moment in a speech from his home.
I'm not scared of going to jail for my beliefs. It will not be for the first time. I will be a prisoner of conscience.
Zuma is actually going to jail for a contempt of court charge. He was found guilty last month of failing to appear at a commission hearing investigating corruption accusations that have dogged the president for years. Zuma's supporters remember him differently, though, a leader who, like Nelson Mandela, stood up to the system of apartheid and helped create a more democratic South Africa. The Biden administration's first report on human trafficking is out and causing shockwaves around the globe. It's considered the most comprehensive annual review of modern slavery, and several countries are taking issue with what the new State Department chose to publish. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
For decades, Cuba has sent thousands of its health workers to other countries on medical missions, responding to disasters and other situations. The program helps Cuba build soft power, and proponents say it offers Cuban medical professionals valuable experience. It has also earned Cuba billions of dollars. That's according to Maria Werlau, executive director of the U.S. nonprofit Cuba Archive.
Many people allege that these doctors go voluntarily without recognizing that these doctors are a captive labor force. And a lot of them don't even make enough to feed their families.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke directly to the issue during the report's release late last week.
They sent doctors and other medical personnel abroad, failed to inform them of the terms of their contracts, confiscate their documents and salaries, threaten them and their family members when they try to leave.
Cuban officials have reacted vehemently, accusing the U.S. of lying, defaming, and slandering their country. And they're not the only ones expressing outrage since the Trafficking in Persons, or TIP, report's release. For the first time, the TIP report placed a NATO member, Turkey, on the congressionally mandated list of countries that use child soldiers. The Turkish Foreign Ministry blasted the U.S., calling the accusations unfounded and unacceptable. It added that the report is, quote, the most striking example of hypocrisy and double standards. But advocates cheered many new aspects of the report. For example, the report includes its first specific focus on LGBTQI people, and it draws a direct connection between modern-day trafficking and systemic and historic racism. Martina Vandenberg is founder and president of the Human Trafficking Legal Center in D.C.
This report is important because it acknowledges problems that have long existed, but that the TIP report has rarely embraced.
The report says many countries failed to adapt their anti-trafficking measures to challenges posed by the pandemic. There was a dramatic increase in the number of people trafficked or at risk of falling into modern slavery. And while anti-trafficking organizations faltered, traffickers thrived, in part by drastically increasing online sex trafficking. This was Carrie Johnstone, acting director of the State Department's Office to Combat Trafficking, speaking at a recent press conference.
Traffickers adapt. They adapt their tactics. They take advantage of new risks and new vulnerabilities that emerge. And that it is incumbent upon governments and all of us who care about human trafficking to similarly adapt and respond to prevent trafficking, prosecute the traffickers, and protect the victims.
Yet the report shows last year there was a stunning overall drop in the apprehension of traffickers worldwide. Prosecutions fell below 10,000 for the first time since at least 2013. Convictions are down by almost half to barely more than 5,000. Martina Vandenberg says the numbers point to the depth of the problem.
It's clear that COVID opened the door to the largest wage theft in history. Walking COVID back, walking the abuse of workers back, is going to be incredibly difficult. And we need much more than rhetoric. We need real structural changes.
The worst drops in convictions were in Asia. Thailand was downgraded and placed on a watch list for catching and charging fewer suspects. The Thai Foreign Ministry angrily dismissed the report as unfair. Malaysia was downgraded to the worst ranking because of the alleged exploitation of migrant workers there, but its response was more positive. The Malaysian Human Services Ministry says it takes those concerns seriously and has vowed to conduct a review. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Worldwide, another sad marker in the pandemic, more than 4 million deaths due to COVID-19, according to Johns Hopkins. As countries struggle to acquire vaccines and in many places struggle to convince people to take the vaccines, there are persistent day-to-day problems people are facing in trying to make decisions about their future. For international college students in the U.S., that means navigating the new bureaucracy around COVID-19. As The World's Alana Gordon reports, it's putting stress on young people around the world, as well as on the universities that rely on their tuition dollars.
Abdullah Jamel Alel was psyched about heading to the U.S. last fall to start college at the University of San Francisco. The pandemic threw a wrench in that.
Things didn't go to plan, and I had to take online school back home.
Home is Saudi Arabia, which is 10 hours ahead of San Francisco. So?
Classes started at 3 a.m. So I basically flipped my day around. I sleep in the day and wake up at night just for school. So I had no social life.
All he wanted to do was be on campus. During that time, he tried to secure a travel visa. His appointment kept getting canceled. Then his passport got delayed. By the time he received it, Saudi Arabia had closed its borders. He applied for permission to leave as a student multiple times. Rejected, rejected, rejected.
I mean, right now I'm laughing about it because I'm here. I'm in San Francisco.
He finally made it and cannot wait for the fall semester. But for many international students, the pandemic has put their lives and education in flux. They previously made up about 5% of overall enrollments at U.S. universities and contributed billions of dollars in tuition. One analysis found their enrollment fell by at least 15% last year.
I've been here for 24 years, and certainly last year was unlike anything else, but this year is still not normal.
Megan Amuzu is director of admissions at International House in New York City. It runs a dorm for hundreds of grad students from around the world, and it's been closed. Amuzu says they're reopening August 1st.
There's still a good deal of uncertainty in terms of whether people will be able to get visas to be able to come here. I think there's also a lot of waiting till the last minute. So it's all very up in the air.
Along with visas and housing, students now have to plan for something else. A growing number of universities, nearly 600 now, have enacted a new requirement to return to class, being fully vaccinated against COVID-19. That can be complicated for international students. In many countries, vaccines are scarce, or the ones that are available aren't approved in the U.S. Dr. Marla Gold is Senior Vice Provost for Community Health at Drexel University in Philadelphia. She says they had to really think this through for international students when they imposed a vaccine mandate.
We took the stance, as others have, that we would look at the World Health Organization's list, which is updated frequently. And if the WHO had finalized an acceptance of an international vaccine, that we would accept it here, regardless of whether it was authorized in the U.S. or not.
For those who've gotten a shot that's not approved in the U.S., like Sputnik V, Gold says at Drexel, students will have to get revaccinated with an approved shot. The CDC recommends waiting about a month to do that.
So we have sent a survey out to our international students saying, can you give us some idea of where you are in this? We know you may not be able to access it. We know that you may be nervous. You know, we're here for you. Let us know, because they have to arrive early, they have to be tested on arrival, and then they'll get tested again around day 5 and complete a 7-day quarantine.
Every single university can have theoretically a different policy, and that creates chaos.
Sudhanshu Kaushik directs the North American Association of Indian Students.
Different colleges and universities are doing different things. Stanford is providing specific dorms and areas where you will quarantine. Some institutions are not doing that. Some institutions are providing online classes, and others are saying, oh, you'll just have to do another online semester, which people don't want to do.
Kaushik, an NBA student, formed the group last year right as the pandemic was starting. He was overwhelmed with all the students reaching out to him for support.
I actually dropped out of school to do this.
At first, he says students were just scrambling as campuses shut down. Fast forward, the situation has been especially hard for students in India. The massive outbreak there canceled required school exams. Vaccines are in short supply, and in some cases, the only option is a shot that's not approved elsewhere. So students are having to navigate all this on top of the tricky travel and visa logistics.
I would say that the eagerness to come is still there, but I know many students who basically have gotten just worn out of all these issues and they've deferred or they've just let go of their admission.
Kaushik says universities must be proactive in supporting international students who need flexibility as they plan their returns. That includes making the quarantine and vaccination process easy and accessible. Having these kinds of resources are essential to ensuring safe, thriving, and truly global campuses this fall. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
For high schoolers, the pandemic has also complicated life and a longstanding ritual, the prom. Three students from Ontario, Canada, driven by necessity and opportunity, have put their own twist on the prom. They're among the finalists in Duck Brand Duct Tape's Stuck at Prom Scholarship Competition. The goal? Confect fabulous prom wear from duct tape.
I just thought this would be really interesting to enter, and I was just excited to see what I could make.
Even though her school didn't have prom this year, Erica Avellaneda, a ninth grader in Ottawa, still made a gown.
It took me 17 rolls of duct tape, and it weighs approximately 6 pounds. Definitely probably the heaviest dress I've ever worn.
Erica's dress is electric blue with nature patterns, a bird, a bear, a fox, and the Canadian maple leaf. She says it took her 143 hours to make.
It feels comfortable most of the time. I can't exactly sit down because it'll rip, but it's comfortable for the most part.
The designer of the winning prom outfit will get a $10,000 scholarship. Competition is fierce. Maiwan Yu of Markham, Ontario, made a bright yellow outfit inspired by Chinese opera. She described it in her contest entry video, a billowing skirt and graceful sleeves with accessories that symbolize the warrior.
Here I am kind of making the armor part of my dress.
And from LaSalle, Ontario, senior Ryan Beckick tells how he used 27 rolls of tape to tailor his tuxedo, a red and black goth design, half Grim Reaper, half Angel.
I spent countless hours finding out how to make moving duct tape wings.
Yeah, I'll bet. The three Canadians, along with seven other finalists from the U.S., are pressing their social media followers to vote. The Duck Brand Duct Tape Stuck at Prom contest ends July 14th. Freshman Erica Avellaneda says that even if she does not win, she's learned a lot about dressmaking, and when her senior prom rolls around, at least she'll have her options open.
If I don't end up finding anything I like, last resort, maybe I might make it out of duct tape.
Erica spoke there with our colleagues at CBC Ottawa. We've posted photos of these dresses on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. Duct tape clothing. Alterations as easy as unstick, restick. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. As always, thanks for being with us. We'll see you again tomorrow.